Side 12. The Bachman Books. Four Early Novels. Continuing with Road Work on page 362. He snickered and made himself another drink. He didn't even have to get up. The Southern Comfort, a 48-ounce bottle of 7-Up, and a plastic bowl of ice were all sitting on a small round table by his chair. Back to the game. The Chargers punted. Hugh Fednack, the Mustang's deep man, collected the football and ran it out of the Mustang's 31. Then, behind the steely-eyed generalship of Hank Rocker, who might have seen the Heisman Trophy once in a newsreel, the Mustangs mounted a 6-yard drive. Gene Vorman punted. Andy Cocker of the Chargers returned the ball to the Mustang's 46. And so it goes, as Kurt Vonnegut had so shrewdly pointed out. He had read all of Kurt Vonnegut's books. He liked them mostly because they were funny. On the news last week, it had been reported that the school board of a town called Drake, North Dakota, had burned yay copies of Vonnegut's novel, Slaughterhouse-Five, which was about the Dresden firebombing. When you thought about it, there was a funny connection there. Fred, why don't those highway department fucksticks go build the 784 extension through Drake? I bet they'd love it. George, that's a fine idea. Why don't you write the Blade about that? Fuck you, Fred. The Chargers scored, making it 34-3. Some cheerleaders pranced around on the AstroTurf and shook their asses. He fell into a semi-doze, and when Fred began to get at him, he couldn't shake him off. George, since you don't seem to know what you're doing, let me tell you. Let me spell it out for you, old buddy. Get off my back, Fred. First, the option on the Waterford plant is going to run out. That will happen at midnight on Tuesday. On Wednesday, Tom McCann is going to close their deal with that slavering little piece of St. Patrick's Day shit, Patrick J. Monahan. On Wednesday afternoon or Thursday morning, a big sign that says sold is going up. If anyone from the laundry sees it, maybe you can postpone the inevitable by saying, sure, sold to us. But if Ordner checks, you're dead. Probably he won't, but, Freddy, leave me alone. On Friday, a new sign will go up. That sign will say, site of our new Waterford plant, Tom McCann Shoes. Here we grow again. On Monday, bright and early, you are going to lose your job. Yes, the way I see it, you'll be unemployed before your 10 o'clock coffee break. Then you can come home and tell Mary. I don't know when that will be. The bus ride only takes 15 minutes, so conceivably you could end 20 years of marriage and 20 years of gainful employment in just about half an hour. But after you tell Mary, comes the explanation scene. You could put it off by getting drunk, but sooner or later... Fred, shut your goddamn mouth. Sooner or later, you're going to have to explain just how you lost your job. You'll just have to fess up. Well, Mary, the highway department is going to rip down the First Street plan in a month or so, and I kind of neglected to get us a new one. I kept thinking that this whole 784 extension business was some kind of nightmare I was going to wake up from. Yes, Mary, yes, I located us a new plant. Waterford, that's right, you capiche. But somehow I couldn't go through with it. How much is it going to cost Amoco? Oh, I'd say $1 million or $1.5 million, depending on how long it takes them to find a new plant location and how much business they lose for good. I'm warning you, Fred. Or you could tell her what no one knows better than you, George, that the profit margin on the blue ribbon has gotten so thin that the cost accountants might just throw up their hands and say, let's ditch the whole thing, guys. We'll just take the city's money and buy a penny arcade down in Norton or a nice little pitch and putt out in Russell or Crescent. There's too much potential red ink in this after the sugar that son of a bitch Dawes poured into our gas tank. You can tell her that. Oh, go to hell. But that's just the first movie, and this is a double feature, isn't it? Part two comes when you tell Mary there isn't any house to go to, and there isn't going to be any house. And how are you going to explain that? I'm not doing anything. That's right. You're just some guy who fell asleep in his rowboat. But come Tuesday midnight, your boat is going over the falls, George. For Christ's sweet sake, go see Monahan on Monday and make him an unhappy man. Sign on the dotted line. He'll be in trouble anyway with all those lies you told Ordner Friday night. But you can bail yourself out of that. God knows you've bailed yourself out of trouble before this. Let me alone. I'm almost asleep. It's Charlie, isn't it? This is a way of committing suicide. But it's not fair to Mary, George. It's not fair to anybody. He sat bolt upright, spilling his drink on the rug. No one except maybe me. Then what about the guns, George? What about the guns? Trembling, he picked up his glass and made another drink. November 26, 1973. He was having lunch with Tom Granger at Nicky's, a diner 3 blocks over from the laundry. They were sitting in a booth drinking bottles of beer and waiting for their meals to come. There was a jukebox, and it was playing Goodbye Yellow Brick Road by Elton John. Tom was talking about the Mustangs-Chargers game, which the Chargers had won 37-6. Tom was in love with all the city's sports teams, and their losses sent him into frenzies. Someday, he thought as he listened to Tom castigate the whole Mustangs roster man by man, Tom Granger will cut off one of his ears with a laundry pin and send it to the general manager. A crazy man would send it to the coach, who would laugh and pin it to the locker room bulletin board, but Tom would send it to the general manager, who would brood over it. The food came, brought by a waitress in a white nylon pantsuit. He estimated her age at 300, possibly 304. Ditto weight. A small card over her left breast said, "Gail, thanks for your patronage, Nicky's Diner." Tom had a slice of roast beef that was floating belly up in a plateful of gravy. He had ordered 2 cheeseburgers rare with an order of French fries. He knew the cheeseburgers would be well done. He had eaten at Nicky's before. The 784 extension was going to miss Nicky's by half a block. They ate. Tom finished his tirade about yesterday's game and asked him about the Waterford plant and his meeting with Ordner. "I'm going to sign on Thursday or Friday," he said. "Thought the options ran out on Tuesday." He went through his story about how Tom McCann had decided they didn't want the Waterford plant. It was no fun lying to Tom Granger. He had known Tom for 17 years. He wasn't terribly bright. There was no challenge in lying to Tom. "Oh," Tom said when he had finished, and the subject was closed. He forked roast beef into his mouth and grimaced. "Why do we eat here? The food is lousy here. Even the coffee is. My wife makes better coffee." "I don't know," he said, slipping into the opening. "But do you remember when that new Italian place opened up? We took Mary and Verna." "Yeah, in August. Verna still raves about that ricotta stuff. No, rigatoni. That's what they call it, rigatoni." "And that guy sat down next to us, that big fat guy?"
"Big fat?"
Tom chewed, trying to remember. He shook his head. "You said he was a crook."
"Oh."
His eyes opened wide. He pushed his plate away and lit a Herbert Terryton and dropped the dead match into his plate where it floated on the gravy.
"Yeah, that's right. Sally Magliore."
"Was that his name?"
"Yeah, that's right. Big guy with thick glasses. 9 chins. Salvatore Magliore.
Sounds like the specialty in an Italian whorehouse, don't it? Sally One Eye, they used to call him, on account of he had a cataract on one eye. He had it removed at the Mayo Clinic 3 or 4 years ago. The cataract, not the eye.
Yeah, he's a big crook."
"What's he in?"
"What are they all in?"
Tom asked, tapping his cigarette ash into his plate.
"Dope, girls, gambling, crooked investments, sharking, and murdering other crooks.
Did you see that in the paper just last week? They found some guy in the trunk of his car behind a filling station. Shot 6 times in the head and his throat cut. That's really ridiculous. Why would anyone want to cut a guy's throat after they just shot him 6 times in the head?"
"Organized crime, that's what Sally One Eye is in."
"Does he have a legitimate business?"
"Yeah, I think he does. Out on the landing strip beyond Norton. He sells cars. Magliore's guaranteed okay used cars. A body in every trunk."
Tom laughed and tapped more ashes into his plate. Gail came back and asked them if they wanted more coffee. They both ordered more.
"I got those cotter pins today for the boiler door," Tom said. "They remind me of my dork."
"Is that right?"
"Yeah, you should see those sons of bitches. 9 inches long and 3 through the middle."
"Did you mention my dork?" he asked. And they both laughed and talked shop until it was time to go back to work. He got off the bus that afternoon at Barker Street and went into Duncan's, which was a quiet neighborhood bar. He ordered a beer and listened to Duncan bitch for a little while about the Mustangs-Chargers game. A man came up from the back and told Duncan that the Bola score machine wasn't working right. Duncan went back to look at it, and he sipped his beer and looked at the TV. There was a soaper on, and 2 women were talking in slow, apocalyptic tones about a man named Hank.
Hank was coming home from college, and one of the women had just found out that Hank was her son, the result of a disastrous experiment that had occurred after her high school prom 20 years ago. Freddie tried to say something, and George shut him right up. The circuit breaker was in fine working order. Had been all day. "That's right, you fucking schizo," Fred yelled, and then George sat on him. "Go peddle your papers, Freddie. You're a persona non grata around here." "Of course, I'm not going to tell him," said one of the women on the tube. "How do you expect me to tell him that?"
"Just tell him," said the other woman.
"Why should I tell him? Why should I knock his whole life out of orbit over something that happened 20 years ago? Are you going to lie to him?"
"I'm not going to tell him anything."
"You have to tell him."
"Sharon, I can't afford to tell him."
"If you don't tell him, Betty, I'll tell him myself." "That fucking machine is all fucked to shit," Duncan said, coming back. "That's been a pain in the ass ever since they put it in. Now what have I got to do? Call the fucking Automatic Industries Company. Wait 20 minutes until some dipshit secretary connects me with the right line. Listen to some guy tell me that they're pretty busy, but they'll try to send a guy out Wednesday. Wednesday! Then some guy with his brains between the cheeks of his ass will show up on Friday, drink $4 worth of free beer, fix whatever's wrong, and probably rig something else to break in 2 weeks, and tell me I shouldn't let the guys throw the weights so hard. I used to have pinball machines. That was good. Those machines hardly ever fucked up. But this is progress. If I'm still here in 1980, they'll take out the bola score and put in an automatic blow job. You want another beer?"
"Sure," he said. Duncan went to draw it. He put 50 cents on the bar and walked back to the phone booth beside the broken bola score. He found what he was looking for in the yellow pages under Automobiles New and Used. The listing there said Magliore's Used Cars, Route 16, Norton, 892-4576. Route 16 became Venner Avenue as you went farther into Norton. Venner Avenue was also known as the Landing Strip, where you could get all the things the yellow pages didn't advertise. He put a dime in the phone and dialed Magliore's Used Cars. The phone was picked up on the second ring, and a male voice said, "Magliore's Used Cars." "This is Dawes," he said. "Barton Dawes. Can I talk to Mr. Magliore?"
"Sounds busy, but I'll be glad to help you if I can. Pete Mansey."
"No, it has to be Mr. Magliore, Mr. Mansey. It's about those two Eldorados." "You've got a bum steer," Mansey said. "We're not taking any big cars in trade the rest of the year on account of this energy business. Nobody's buying them, so..." "I'm buying," he said.
"What's that?"
"Two Eldorados, one 1970, one 1972, one gold, one cream. I spoke to Mr. Magliore about them last week. It's a business deal."
"Oh, yeah, right. He really isn't here now, Mr. Dawes. To tell you the truth, he's in Chicago. He's not getting in until 11 o'clock tonight."
Outside, Duncan was hanging a sign on the bola score. The sign said, "Out of order."
"Will he be in tomorrow?"
"Yeah, sure will. Was this a trade deal?"
"No, straight buy."
"One of the specials?"
He hesitated a moment, then said,
"Yes, that's right. Would 4 o'clock be okay?"
"Sure, fine."
"Thanks, Mr. Mansey."
"I'll tell him you called."
"You do that," he said, and hung up carefully. His palms were sweating. Merv Griffin was chatting with celebrities when he got home. There was nothing in the mail. That was a relief. He went into the living room. Mary was sipping a hot rum concoction in a teacup. There was a box of Kleenex beside her, and the room smelled of Vicks. "Are you all right?" he asked her.
"Don't kiss me," she said,
and her voice had a distant fog-horning quality.
"I came down with something."
"Poor kid." He kissed her forehead.
"I hate to ask you, Bard, but would you get the groceries tonight? I was going with Meg Carter, but I had to call her and beg off."
"Sure. Are you running a favor?"
"No. Well, maybe a little."
"Want me to make an appointment with Fontaine for you?"
"No. I will tomorrow if I don't feel better."
"You're really stuffy."
"Yes, the Vicks helped for a while, but now..."
She shrugged and smiled wanly.
"I sound like Donald Duck."
He hesitated a moment and then said, "I'll be home a little bit late tomorrow night."
"Oh?
I'm going out to Northside to look at a house. It seems like a good one. 6 rooms, a little backyard, not too far from the Hobarts. Freddy said quite clearly, "Why, you dirty low-life son of a bitch." Mary brightened.
"That's wonderful. Can't I go look with you?"
"Better not with that cold."
"I'll bundle up."
"Next time," he said firmly.
"Okay." She looked at him. "Thank God you're finally moving on this," she said. "I was worried."
"Don't worry."
"I won't."
She took a sip of the hot rum drink and snuggled against him. He could hear her breath snuffling in and out. Merv Griffin was chatting with James Brolin about his new movie, Westworld, soon to be showing at barber shops all over the country. After a while, Mary got up and put TV dinners in the oven. He got up, switched the TV over to reruns of F Troop, and tried not to listen to Freddy. After a while, though, Freddy changed his tune. "Do you remember how you got the first TV, Georgie?" He smiled a little, looking not at Forrest Tucker, but right through him. "I do, Fred, I surely do." They had come home one evening, about 2 years after they were married, from the Upshaws, where they had been watching Your Hit Parade and Dan Fortune, and Mary had asked him if he didn't think Donna Upshaw had seemed a little, well, off. Now, sitting here, he could remember Mary, slim and oddly, fetchingly taller in a pair of white sandals she had gotten to celebrate summer. She had been wearing white shorts, too. Her legs looked long and coltish, as if they really might go all the way up to her chin. In truth, he hadn't been very interested in whether or not Donna Upshaw had seemed a little off. He had been interested in divesting Mary of those tight shorts. That had been where his interest lay, not to put too fine a point on it. "Maybe she's getting a little tired of serving Spanish peanuts to half the neighborhood just because they're the only people on the street with a TV," he said. He supposed he had seen the little frown line between her eyes, the one that always meant Mary was cooking something up. But by then they were halfway upstairs. His hand was roaming down over the seat of those shorts, what little seat there was. And it wasn't until later, until after, that she said, "How much would a table model cost us, Bart?" Half asleep, he had answered, "Well, I guess we could get a Motorola for 28, maybe 30 bucks, but the Philco. Not a radio, a TV." He sat up, turned on the lamp, and looked at her. She was lying there naked, the sheet down around her hips, and although she was smiling at him, he thought she was serious. It was Mary's "I dare you" grin. "Mary, we can't afford a TV. How much for a table model, a GE or a Philco or something?" "New?" "New?" He considered the question, watching the play of lamplight across the lovely round curves of her breasts. She had been so much slimmer then. "Although she's hardly a fatty now, George," he reproached himself. "Never said she was, Freddy, my boy." So much more alive, somehow. Even her hair had crackled out its own message. Alive, awake, aware. "Around $750, he said, thinking that would douse the grin. But it hadn't. "Well, look," she said, sitting up Indian fashion in bed, her legs crossed under the sheet. "I am," he said, grinning. "Not at that," but she laughed, and the flush had spread prettily down her cheeks to her neck, although she hadn't pulled the sheet up, he remembered. "What's on your mind?" "Why do men want a TV?" she asked. "To watch all the sports on the weekends. And why do women want one? Those soap operas in the afternoon. You can listen while you iron or put your feet up if your work's done. Now suppose we each found something to do, something that pays. During that time we'd otherwise just be sitting around. Reading a book, or maybe even making love," he suggested. "We always find time for that," she said, and laughed and blushed. And her eyes were dark in the lamplight, and it threw a warm semicircular shadow between her breasts. And he knew then that he was going to give in to her. He would have promised her a $1,500 Zenith console model if she would just let him make love to her again. And at the thought, he felt himself stiffening, felt the snake turning to stone, as Mary had once said when she'd had a little too much to drink at the Ridpath New Year's Eve party. And now, 18 years later, he felt the snake turning to stone again. Over a memory. Well, all right, he said. I'm going to moonlight weekends, and you're going to moonlight afternoons. But what, dear Mary, oh, not-so-virgin Mary, are we going to do? She pounced on him, giggling, her breasts a soft weight on his stomach. Flat enough in those days, Freddy, not a sign of a bay window. That's the trick of it, she said. What's today, June 18th? That's right. Well, you do your weekend things, and on December 18th, we'll put our money together and buy a toaster, he said, grinning. And get that TV, she said solemnly. I'm sure we can do it, Bart. Then the giggles broke out again. But the fun part will be that we won't tell each other what we're up to until after. Just as long as I don't see a red light over the door when I come home from work tomorrow, he said, capitulating. She grabbed him, got on top of him, started to tickle. The tickling turned to caresses. Bring it to me, she whispered against his neck, and gripped him with gentle yet excruciating pressure, guiding him and squeezing him at the same time. Put it in me, Bart. And later, in the dark again, hands crossed behind his head, he said, We don't tell each other, right? Nope. Mary, what brought this on? What I said about Donna Upshaw not wanting to serve Spanish peanuts to half the neighborhood? There were no giggles in her voice when she replied. Her voice was flat, austere, and just a little frightening. A faint taste of winter in the warm June air of their third-floor walk-up apartment. I don't like to freeload, Bart, and I won't, ever. For a week and a half, he had turned her quirky little proposal over in his mind, wondering just what in the hell he was supposed to do to bring in his half of the $750. And probably more like three-quarters of it, the way it'll turn out, he thought, on the next 20 or so weekends. He was a little old to be mowing lawns for quarters, and Mary had gotten a look, a smug sort of look, that gave him the idea that she had either landed something or was landing something. Better get on your track shoes, Bart, he thought, and had to laugh out loud at himself. Pretty fine days, weren't they, Freddy? He asked himself now as Forrest Tucker and F Troop gave way to a cereal commercial where an animated rabbit preached that tricks are for kids. They were, Georgie. They were fucking great days. One day he had been unlocking his car after work, and he had happened to look at the big industrial smokestack behind dry cleaning, and it came to him. He had put the keys back in his pocket and went in to talk to Don Tarkington. Don leaned back in his chair, looked at him from under shaggy eyebrows that were even then turning white, as were the hairs which bushed out of his ears and curled from his nostrils, hands steepled on his chest. Paint the stack, Don said. He nodded. Weekends. He nodded again. Flat fee. $300. And again. You're crazy. He burst out laughing. Don smiled a little. You got a dope habit, Bart? No, he said. But I've got a little thing on with Mary. A bet? The shaggy eyebrows went up half a mile. More gentlemanly than that. A wager, I guess you'd call it. Anyway, Don, the stack needs the paint, and I need the $300. What do you say? A painting contractor would charge you 4 1/4. You checked. I checked. You crazy bastard, Don said and burst out laughing. You'll probably kill yourself. Yeah, I probably will, he said and began laughing himself. And here, 18 years later, as the tricks rabbit gave way to the evening news, he sat grinning like a fool. And that was how, one weekend after the 4th of July, he found himself on a shaky scaffolding 80 feet in the air, a paintbrush in his hand and his ass wagging in the wind. Once a sudden afternoon thunderstorm had come up, snapped one of the ropes which held up the scaffolding as easily as you might snap a piece of twine holding a package, and he almost did fall. The safety rope around his waist had held, and he had lowered himself to the roof, heart thudding like a drum, sure that no power on earth would get him back up there, not for a lousy table model TV. But he had gone back. Not for the TV, but for Mary. For the look of the lamplight on her small, up-tilted breasts. For the dare-you grin on her lips and in her eyes. Her dark eyes, which could sometimes turn so light or darken even more into summer thunderheads. By early September, he had finished the stack. It stood cleanly white against the sky, a chalk mark on a blue board, slim and bright. He looked at it with some pride as he scrubbed his spattered forearms with paint thinner. Don Tarkington paid him by check. "Not a bad job," was his only comment, "considering the jackass that did it." He picked up another $50, paneling the walls of Henry Chalmers' new family room. In those days, Henry had been the plant foreman, and painting Ralph Tremont's aging Chris Craft. When December 18th rolled around, he and Mary sat down at their small dining room table, like adversary but oddly friendly gunslingers, and he put $390 in cash in front of her. He had banked the money, and there had been some interest. She put $416 with it. She took it from her apron pocket. It made a much bigger wad than his, because most of it was ones and fives. He gasped at it and then said, "What the Christ did you do, Mayor?" Smiling, she said, "I made 26 dresses, hemmed up 49 dresses, hemmed down 64 dresses. I made 31 skirts. I crocheted 3 samplers. I hooked 4 rugs, one of latch hook style. I made 5 sweaters, 2 afghans, and 1 complete set of table linen. I embroidered 63 handkerchiefs, 12 sets of towels, and 12 sets of pillowcases, and I can see all the monograms in my sleeve." Laughing, she held out her hands, and for the first time he really noticed the thick pads of calluses on the tips of the fingers, like the calluses a guitar player eventually builds up. "Oh, Christ, Mary," he said, his voice hoarse. "Christ, look at your hands." "My hands are fine," she said, and her eyes darkened and danced. "And you looked very cute up there on the smokestack, Bart. I thought once I'd buy a slingshot and see if I couldn't hit you in the butt." Roaring, he had jumped up and chased her through the living room and into the bedroom, where we spent the rest of the afternoon, as I recall it, Freddy, old man. They discovered that they not only had enough for a table model TV, but that for another $40, they actually could have a console model. RCA had jumped the model year, the proprietor of John's TV downtown told them. John's was already buried under the 784 extension, of course, long gone, along with the grand and everything else, and was going for broke. He would be happy to let them have it, and for just $10 a week. "No," Mary said. John looked pained. "Lady, it's only 4 weeks. You're hardly signing your life away on easy credit terms." "Just a minute," Mary said, and led him outside into the pre-Christmas cold where carols tangled in each other up and down the street. "Mary," he said, "he's right. It's not as if..." "The first thing we buy on credit ought to be our own house, Bart," she said. A faint line appeared between her eyes. "Now listen." They went back inside. "Will you hold it for us?" he asked John.
"I guess so, for a while, but this is my busy season, Mr. Doss. How long?"
"Just over the weekend," he said. "I'll be in Monday night." They had spent that weekend in the country, bundled up against the cold and the snow, which threatened but did not fall. They drove slowly up and down back roads, giggling like kids, a six-pack on the seat for him and a bottle of wine for Mary, and they saved the beer bottles and picked up more, bags of beer bottles, bags of soda bottles, each one of the small ones worth 2 cents, the big ones worth a nickel. It had been one hell of a weekend, Bart thought now. Mary's hair had been long, flowing out behind her over that imitation leather coat of hers, the color flaming in her cheeks. He could see her now, walking up a ditch filled with fallen autumn leaves, kicking through them with her boots, producing a noise like a steady, low forest fire. Then the click of a bottle, and she raised it up in triumph, waggled it at him from across the road, grinning like a kid. "They don't have returnable bottles anymore either, Georgie. The gospel these days is no deposit, no return. Use it up and throw it out." That Monday after work, they had turned in $31 worth of bottles, visiting 4 different supermarkets to spread the wealth around. They had arrived at John's 10 minutes before the store closed. "I'm $9 short," he told John. John wrote paid across the bill of sale that had been taped to the RCA console. Merry Christmas, Mr. Dawes, he said. Let me get my dolly and I'll help you out with it. They got it home, and an excited Dick Keller from the first floor helped him carry it up. And that night they had watched TV until the national anthem had come on the last operating channel, and then they had made love in front of the test pattern, both of them with raging headaches from eye strain. TV had rarely looked so good since. Mary came in and saw him looking at the TV, his empty Scotch Rocks glass in his hand. Your dinner's ready, Bart, she said. You want it in here? He looked at her, wondering exactly when he had seen the dare you grin on her lips for the last time. Exactly when the little line between her eyes had begun to be there all the time, like a wrinkle, a scar, a tattoo proclaiming age. You wonder about some things, he thought, that you'd never in God's world want to know. Now, why the hell is that?
Bart?
Let's eat in the dining room, he said. He got up and snapped the TV off.
All right.
They sat down. He looked at the meal in the aluminum tray. Six little compartments, and something that looked pressed in each one. The meat had gravy on it. It was his impression that the meats in TV dinners always had gravy on them. TV dinner meat would look naked without gravy, he thought. And then he remembered his thought about Lauren Green for absolutely no reason at all. Boy, I'll snatch you bald-headed. It didn't amuse him this time. Somehow it scared him. What were you spiling about in the living room, Bart? Mary asked. Her eyes were red from her cold and her nose had a chapped raw look. I don't remember, he said. And for the moment he thought, I'll just scream now, I think. For lost things. For your grin, Mary. Pardon me while I just throw back my head and scream for the grin that's never there on your face anymore, okay? You looked very happy, she said. Against his will, it was a secret thing. And tonight he felt he needed his secret things. Tonight his feelings felt as raw as Mary's nose looked. Against his will, he said, I was thinking of the time we went out picking up bottles to finish paying for that TV, the RCA console.
Oh, that,
Mary said, and then sneezed into her hanky over her TV dinner. He ran into Jack Hobart at the Soppin' Shop. Jack's cart was full of frozen foods, heat-and-serve canned products, and a lot of beer. Jack, he said, what are you doing way over here? Jack smiled a little. I haven't got used to the other store yet, so I thought, where's Ellen? She had to fly back to Cleveland, he said. Her mother died. Jesus, I'm sorry, Jack. Wasn't that sudden? Shoppers were moving all around them under the cold overhead lights. Muzak came down from hidden speakers, old standards that you could never quite recognize. A woman with a full cart passed them, dragging a screaming three-year-old in a blue parka with snot on the sleeves. Yeah, it was, Jack Hobart said. He smiled meaninglessly and looked down into his cart. There was a large yellow bag there that said, Kitty Pan, Kitty Litter. Use it, throw it away. Sanitary. Yeah, it was. She'd been feeling punk, thank you, but she thought it might have been a, you know, sort of leftover from change of life. It was cancer. They opened her up, took a look, and sewed her right back up. 3 weeks later, she was dead. Hell of a hard thing for Ellen. I mean, she only 20 years younger. Yeah, he said. So she's out in Cleveland for a little while. Yeah. Yeah. They looked at each other and grinned shamefacedly over the fact of death. How is it? He asked. Out there in Northside.
Well, I'll tell you the truth, Bart. Nobody seems very friendly.
No?
You know Ellen works down at the bank?
Yeah, sure. Well, a lot of the girls used to have a carpool. I used to let Ellen have the car every Thursday. That was her part. There's a pool out in Northside into the city, but all the women who use it are part of some club that Ellen can't join unless she's been there at least a year. That sounds pretty damn close to discrimination, Jack. Fuck them, Jack said angrily. Helen wouldn't join their goddamn club if they crawled up the street on their hands and knees. I got her her own car, a used Buick. She loves it. Should have done it 2 years ago. How's the house? It's fine, Jack said, and sighed. The electricity's high, though. You should see our bill. That's no good for people with a kid in college. They shuffled. Now that Jack's anger had passed, the shame-faced grin was back on his face. He realized that Jack was almost pathetically glad to see someone from the neighborhood, and was prolonging the moment. He had a sudden vision of Jack knocking around in the new house, the sound from the TV filling the rooms with phantom company, his wife 1,000 miles away seeing her mother into the ground. "Listen, why don't you come back to the house?" he asked. "We'll have a couple of six-packs and listen to Howard Cosell explain everything that's wrong with the NFL. "Hey, that'd be great. Just let me call Mary after we check out." He called Mary, and Mary said okay. She said she would put some frozen pastries in the oven and then go to bed so she wouldn't give Jack her cold. "How does he like it out there?" she asked. "Okay, I guess. Mary, Ellen's mother died. She's out in Cleveland for the funeral. Cancer."
"Oh, no."
"So I thought Jack might like the company, you know."
"Sure, of course." She paused.
"Did you tell him we might be neighbors before long?"
"No," he said. "I didn't tell him that."
"You ought to. It might cheer it up."
"Sure. Goodbye, Mary."
"Bye.
Take some aspirin before you go to bed."
"I will."
"Bye."
"Bye, George."
She hung up. He looked at the phone, chilled.
She only called him that when she was very pleased with him. Fred and George had been Charlie's game originally. He and Jack Hobart went home and watched the game. They drank a lot of beer, but it wasn't so good. When Jack was getting into his car to go home at 12:15, he looked up bleakly and said,
"That goddamn highway, that's what fucked up the works."
It sure did.
He thought Jack looked old, and it scared him.
Jack was about his age. "You keep in touch, Bart."
"I will."
They grinned hollowly at each other, a little drunk, a little sick. He watched Jack's car until its taillights had disappeared down the long, curving hill. November 27, 1973. He was a little hungover and a little sleepy from staying up so late. The sound of the laundry washers kicking onto the extract cycle seemed loud in his ears, and the steady thump hiss of the shirt presses and the ironer made him want to wince. Freddy was worse. Freddy was playing the very devil today. "Listen," Fred was saying, "this is your last chance, my boy. You've still got all afternoon to get over to Monahan's office. If you let it wait until 5 o'clock, it's going to be too late." "The option doesn't run out until midnight."
"Sure it doesn't, but right after work, Monahan is going to feel a pressing need to go see some relatives in Alaska. For him, it means the difference between a $45,000 commission and $50,000, the price of a new car. For that kind of money, you don't need a pocket calculator. For that kind of money, you might discover relatives in the sewer system under Bombay."
But it didn't matter. It had gone too far. He had let the machine run without him too long. He was hypnotized by the coming explosion, almost lusted for it. His belly groaned in its own juices. He spent most of the afternoon in the washroom, watching Ron Stone and Dave run test loads with one of the new laundry products. It was loud in the washroom. The noise hurt his tender head, but it kept him from hearing his thoughts. After work, he got his car out of the parking lot. Mary had been glad to let him have it for the day since he was seeing about their new house, and drove through downtown and through Norton. In Norton, blacks stood around on street corners and outside bars. Restaurants advertised different kinds of soul food. Children hopped and danced on chalked sidewalk grids. He saw a pimpmobile, a huge pink Eldorado Cadillac, pull up in front of an anonymous brownstone apartment building. The man who got out was a Wilt Chamberlain-sized black in a white planter's hat and a white ice cream suit with pearl buttons and black platform shoes with huge gold buckles on the sides. He carried a malacca stick with a large ivory ball on the top. He walked slowly, majestically around to the hood of the car, where a set of caribou antlers were mounted. A tiny silver spoon hung on a silver chain around his neck and winked in the thin autumn sun. He watched the man in the rearview mirror as the children ran to him for sweets. 9 blocks later, the tenements thinned to ragged open fields that were still soft and marshy. Oily water stood between hummocks and puddles, their surfaces flat, deadly rainbows. On the left, near the horizon, he could see a plane landing at the city's airport. He was now on Route 16, traveling past the exurban sprawl between the city and the city limits. He passed McDonald's, Shakey's, Nino's Steak Pit. He passed a Dairy Freeze and the Noddy Time Motel, both closed for the season. He passed the Norton Drive-In, where the marquee said, "Fry Sat Sun, Restless Wives, Some Came Running, Rated X, 8-Ball. He passed a bowling alley and a driving range that was closed for the season. Gas stations, two of them with signs that said, "Sorry, no gas." It was still 4 days until they got their gasoline allotments for December. He couldn't find it in himself to feel sorry for the country as a whole, as it went into this science fiction-style crisis. The country had been pigging petroleum for too long to warrant his sympathy. But he could feel sorry for the little men with their peckers caught in the swing of a big door. A mile farther on, he came to Magliore's used cars. He didn't know what he had expected, but he felt disappointed. It looked like a cut-rate, fly-by-night operation. Cars were lined up on the lot facing the road, under looped lines of flapping banners, red, yellow, blue, green, that had been tied between light standards that would shine down on the product at night. Prices and slogans soaked on the windshields. $795, runs good. And $550, good transportation. And on a dusty old Valiant with flat tires and a cracked windshield, $75, mechanic special. A salesman wearing a gray-green topcoat was nodding and smiling noncommittally as a young kid in a red silk jacket talked to him. They were standing by a blue Mustang with cancer of the rocker panels. The kid said something vehement and thumped the driver's side door with the flat of his hand. Rust flaked off in a small flurry. The salesman shrugged and went on smiling. The Mustang just sat there and got a little older. There was a combination office and garage in the center of the lot. He parked and got out of his car. There was a lift in the garage, and an old Dodge with giant fins was up on it. A mechanic walked out from under, holding a muffler in both grease-gloved hands like a chalice. "Say, you can't park there, mister. That's in the right-of-way." "Where should I park?" "Take it around back if you're going in the office." He drove the LTD around to the back, creeping carefully down the narrow way between the corrugated metal side of the garage and a row of cars. He parked behind the garage and got out. The wind, strong and cutting, made him wince. The heater had disarmed his face, and he had to squint his eyes to keep them from tearing. There was an automobile junkyard back here. It stretched for acres, amazing the eye. Most of the cars had been gutted of parts, and now they sat on their wheel rims or axles like the victims of some awful plague who were too contagious to even be dragged to the dead pit. Grills with empty headlight sockets gazed at him raptly. He walked back out front. The mechanic was installing the muffler. An open bottle of Coke was balanced on a pile of tires to his right. He called to the mechanic, "Is Mr. Magliore in?" Talking to mechanics always made him feel like an asshole. He had gotten his first car 24 years ago, and talking to mechanics still made him feel like a pimply teenager. The mechanic looked over his shoulder and kept working his socket wrench. "Yeah, him and Mansi both in the office." "Thanks." "Sure." He went into the office. The walls were imitation pine. The floor, muddy squares of red and white linoleum. There were two old chairs with a pile of tattered magazines between them. Outdoor life, field and stream, true Argosy. No one was sitting in the chairs. There was one door, probably leading to an inner office, and on the left side, a little cubicle like a theater box office. A woman was sitting in there working an adding machine. A yellow pencil was poked into her hair. A pair of harlequin glasses hung against her scant bosom, held by a rhinestone chain. He walked over to her, nervous now. He wet his lips before he spoke. "Excuse me." She looked up. "Yes?" He had a crazy impulse to say, "I'm here to see Sally One-Eye, bitch. Shake your tail." Instead, he said, "I have an appointment with Mr. Magliore." "You do?" She looked at him wearily for a moment, and then riffled through some slips on the table beside the adding machine. She pulled one out. "Your name is Dawes, Barton Dawes?" "That's right." "Go right in." She stretched her lips at him and began to peck at the adding machine again. He was very nervous. Surely they knew he had conned them. They were running some kind of midnight auto sales here. That much had been obvious from the way Mancy had spoken to him yesterday. And they knew he knew. Maybe it would be better to go right out the door, drive like hell to Monahan's office, and maybe catch him before he left for Alaska or Timbuktu or wherever he would be leaving for. "Finally," Freddy said, "the man shows some sense." He walked over to the door in spite of Freddy, opened it, and stepped into the inner office. There were two men. The one behind the desk was fat and wearing heavy glasses. The other was razor thin and dressed in a salmon pink sports coat that made him think of Vinny. He was bending over the desk. They were looking at a J.C. Whitney catalog. They looked up at him. Magliore smiled from behind his desk. The glasses made his eyes appear faded and enormous, like the yolks of poached eggs. "Mr. Dawes?" "That's right." "Glad you could drop by. Want to shut the door?" "Okay." He shut it. When he turned back, Magliore was no longer smiling. Neither was Mancy. They were just looking at him, and the room temperature seemed to have gone down 20 degrees. "Okay," Magliore said. "What is this shit?"
"I wanted to talk to you."
"I talk for free, but not to shitbirds like you. You call up Pete and give him a line of crap about 2 Eldorados.
He pronounced it Eldorados.
"You talk to me, mister. You tell me what your act is."
Standing by the door, he said, "I heard maybe you sold things."
"Yeah, that's right. Cars. I sell cars."
"No," he said, "other stuff. Stuff like..." He looked around at the fake pine-paneled walls. God knew how many agencies were bugging this place. "Just stuff," he finished, and the words came out on crutches.
"You mean stuff like dope and whores and off-track betting? Or did you want to buy a hitter to knock off your wife or your boss?"
Magliore saw him wince and laughed harshly.
"That's not too bad, mister, not bad at all for a shitbird. That's the big what-if-this-place-is-bugged act, right? That's number one at the police academy, am I right?"
"Look, I'm not a..."
"Shut up,"
Mancy said. He was holding the J.C. Whitney catalog in his hands. His fingernails were manicured. He had never seen manicured nails exactly like that, except on TV commercials where the announcer had to hold a bottle of aspirin or something. "If Sal wants you to talk, he'll tell you to talk." He blinked and shut his mouth. This was like a bad dream.
"You guys get dumber every day," Magliore said. "That's all right. I like to deal with dummies. I'm used to dealing with dummies. I'm good at it. Now, not that you don't know it, but this office is as clean as a whistle. We wash it every week. I got a cigar box full of bugs at home. Contact mics, button mics, pressure mics. Sony tape recorders no bigger than your hand. They don't even try that much anymore. Now they send shitbirds like you."
He heard himself say, "I'm not a shitbird." An expression of exaggerated surprise spread across Magliore's face. He turned to Mancy.
"Did you hear that? He said he wasn't a shitbird."
"Yeah, I heard that," Mancy said.
"Does he look like a shitbird to you?"
"Yeah, he does," Mancy said.
"He even talks like a shitbird, doesn't he?"
"Yeah."
"So if you're not a shitbird," Magliore said, turning back to him, "what are you?"
"I'm..." He began, not sure of just what to say. What was he? Fred, where are you when I need you?
Come on, come on, Mugliore said. State police, city, IRS, FBI. He looked like prime FBI to you, Pete.
Yeah, Pete said.
Not even the city police would send out a shitbird like you, mister. You must be FBI or a private detective, which is it?
He began to feel angry. Throw him out, Pete, Mugliore said, losing interest. Manzi started forward, still holding the J.C. Whitney catalog. You stupid dork, he suddenly yelled at Mugliore. You probably see policemen under your bed, you're so stupid. You probably think they're home screwing your wife when you're here. Mugliore looked at him, magnified eyes widening. Manzi froze, a look of unbelief on his face.
Dork?
Mugliore said, turning the word over in his mouth the way a carpenter will turn a tool he doesn't know over in his hands.
Did he call me a dork?
He was stunned by what he had said. I'll take him out back, Manzi said, starting forward again.
Hold it,
Mugliore breathed. He looked at him with honest curiosity.
Did you call me a dork?
I'm not a cop, he said. I'm not a crook either. I'm just a guy that heard you sold stuff to people who had the money to buy it. Well, I've got the money. I didn't know you had to say the secret word or have a Captain Midnight decoder ring or all that silly shit. Yes, I called you a dork. I'm sorry I did if it will stop this man from beating me up. He wet his lips and could think of no way to continue. Mugliore and Manzi were looking at him with fascination, as if he had just turned into a Greek marble statue before their very eyes.
Dork, Mugliore breathed. Frisk this guy, Pete.
Pete's hands slapped his shoulders and he turned around. Put your hands on the wall, Manzi said, his mouth beside his ear. He smelled like Listerine.
Feet out behind you, just like on the cop shows.
I don't watch the cop shows, he said, but he knew what Manzi meant. And he put himself in the frisk position. Manzi ran his hands up his legs, patted his crotch with all the impersonality of a doctor, slipped a hand into his belt, ran his hands up his side, slipped a finger under his collar.
Clean,
Manzi said.
Turn around, you,
Mugliore said. He turned around. Mugliore was still regarding him with fascination.
Come here.
He walked over. Mugliore tapped the glass top of his desk. Under the glass, there were several snapshots. A dark woman who was grinning into the camera with sunglasses pushed back on top of her wiry hair. Olive-skinned kids splashing in a pool. Mugliore himself walking along the beach in a black bathing suit looking like King Farouk. A large collie at his heel.
Dump out, he said.
Huh?
Everything in your pockets, dump it out.
He thought of protesting, then thought of Manzi, who was hovering just behind his left shoulder. He dumped out. From his topcoat pockets, the stubs of the tickets from the last movie he and Mary had gone to. Something with a lot of singing in it, he couldn't remember the name. He took off his topcoat. From his suit coat, a Zippo lighter with his initials, BGD, engraved on it. A package of flints. A single Phillies cheroot. A tin of Phillips Milk of Magnesia tablets. A receipt from A&S Tires, the place that had put on his snow tires. Manzi looked at it and said with some satisfaction,
Christ, you got burned.
He took off his jacket. Nothing in his shirt breast pocket but a ball of lint. From the right front pocket of his pants, he produced his car keys and 40 cents in change, mostly in nickels. For some reason he had never been able to fathom, nickels seemed to gravitate to him. There was never a dime for the parking meter, only nickels which wouldn't fit. He put his wallet on the glass-top desk with the rest of his things. Mugliore picked up the wallet and looked at the faded monogram on it. Mary had given it to him on their anniversary 4 years ago.
What's the G for?
Mugliore asked. George. He opened the wallet and dealt the contents out in front of him like a solitaire hand. $43 in twenties and ones. Credit cards, Shell, Sunoco, Arco, Grants, Sears,
Carey's Department Store, American Express. Driver's license. Social Security. A blood donor card, type A positive. Library card. A plastic flip folder. A photostated birth certificate card. Several old receipted bills, some of them falling apart along the fold seams from age. Stamped checking account deposit slips, some of them going back to June.
What's the matter with you? Magliore asked irritably. Don't you ever clean out your wallet? You load a wallet up like this and carry it around for a year, that wallet's hurting.
He shrugged. I hate to throw things away. He was thinking that it was strange how Magliore calling him a shitbird had made him angry, but Magliore criticizing his wallet didn't bother him at all. Magliore opened the flip folder, which was filled with snapshots. The top one was of Mary, her eyes crossed, her tongue popped out at the camera. An old picture. She had been slimmer then.
This your wife?
Yeah. Bet she's pretty when there ain't a camera stuck in her face. He flipped up another one and smiled.
Your little boy? I got one about that age. Can he hit a baseball? Wacko, I guess he can.
That was my son, yes. He's dead now.
Too bad. Accident?
Brain tumor. Magliore nodded and looked at the other pictures. Fingernail clippings of a life. The house on Crestallen Street West. He and Tom Granger standing in the laundry washroom. A picture of him at the podium of the Launderers' Convention the year it had been held in the city. He had introduced the keynote speaker. A backyard barbecue with him standing by the grill in a chef's hat and an apron that said, Dad's cooking, Mom's looking. Magliore put the flip folder down, bundled the credit cards into a pile, and gave them to Mancy.
Have them photocopied, he said.
And take one of those deposit slips. His wife keeps the checkbook under lock and key, just like mine. Magliore laughed. Mancy looked at him skeptically.
Are you going to do business with this shitbird?
Don't call him a shitbird, and maybe he won't call me a dork again. He uttered a wheezy laugh that ended with unsettling suddenness.
You just mind your business, Petey. Don't tell me mine.
Mancy laughed, but exited in a modified stalk. Magliore looked at him when the door was closed. He chuckled. He shook his head.
Dork, he said. By God, I thought I'd been called everything.
Why is he going to photocopy my credit cards?
We have part of a computer. No one owns all of it. People use it on a time-sharing basis. If a person knows the right codes, that person can tap into the memory banks of over 50 corporations that have city business. So I'm going to check on you. If you're a cop, we'll find out. If those credit cards are fake, we'll find out. If they're real but not yours, we'll find that out, too. But you got me convinced. I think you're straight. Dork.
He shook his head and laughed.
Was yesterday Monday? Mister, you're lucky you didn't call me a dork on Monday.
Can I tell you what I want to buy now?
You could. And if you were a cop with 6 recorders on you, you still couldn't touch me. It's called entrapment. But I don't want to hear it now. You come back tomorrow, same time, same station, and I'll tell you if I want to hear it. Even if you're straight, I may not sell you anything. You know why?
Why? Magliore laughed.
Because I think you're a fruitcake. Driving on 3 wheels. Flying on instruments.
Why? Because I called you a name?
No, Magliore said. Because you remind me of something that happened to me when I was a kid about my son's age. There was a dog that lived in the neighborhood where I grew up, Hell's Kitchen in New York. That was before the Second World War, in the Depression. And this guy named Piazzi had a black mongrel bitch named Andrea. But everybody just called her Mr. Piazzi's dog. He kept her chained up all the time, but that dog never got mean. Not until this one hot day in August.
It might have been 1937. She jumped the kid that came up to pet her and put him in the hospital for a month. 37 stitches in his neck. But I knew it was going to happen. That dog was out in the hot sun all day, every day, all summer long. In the middle of June, it stopped wagging its tail when kids came up to pet it. Then it started to roll its eyes. By the end of July, it would growl way back in its throat when some kid patted it. When it started doing that, I stopped patting Mr. Piazzi's dog. And the guy said, "What's the matter, Sally? You chicken shit?" And I said, "No, I ain't chicken shit, but I ain't stupid either. That dog's gone mean." And they all said, "Up your ass, Mr. Piazzi's dog don't bite. She never bit nobody. She wouldn't bite a baby that stuck its head down her throat." And I said, "You go on and pat her. There's no law that says you can't pat a dog. But I ain't gonna." And so they all go around saying, "Sally's chicken shit. Sally's a girl. Sally wants his mama to walk him past Mr. Piazzi's dog. You know how kids are." "I know," he said. Mansi had come back in with his credit cards and was standing by the door listening. And one of the kids who was yelling the loudest was the kid who finally got it. Luigi Braticelli, his name was. A good Jew like me, you know. Magliore laughed. He went up to pat Mr. Piazzi's dog one day in August when it was hot enough to fry an egg on the sidewalk, and he ain't talked above a whisper since that day. He's got a barber shop in Manhattan, and they call him Whispering G. Magliore smiled at him. "You remind me of Mr. Piazzi's dog. You ain't growling yet, but if someone was to pat you, you'd roll your eyes. And you stopped wagging your tail a long time ago. Pete, give this man his things." Mansi gave him the bundle. "You come back tomorrow and we'll talk some more," Magliore said.
He watched him putting things back into his wallet.
"And you really ought to clean that mess out. You're racking that wallet all to shit."
"Maybe I will," he said. "Pete, show this man out to his car." "Sure." He had the door open and was stepping out when Magliore called after him.
"You know what they did to Mr. Piazzi's dog, mister? They took her to the pound and gassed her."
After supper, when John Chancellor was telling about how the reduced speed limit on the Jersey Turnpike had probably been responsible for fewer accidents, Mary asked him about the house.
"Termites," he said.
Her face fell like an express elevator.
"Oh. No good, huh?
Well, I'm going out again tomorrow. If Tom Granger knows a good exterminator, I'll take the guy out with me. Get an expert opinion. Maybe it isn't as bad as it looks."
"I hope it isn't. The backyard and all."
She trailed off wistfully. "Oh, you're a prince," Freddy said suddenly. "A veritable prince. How come you're so good to your wife, George? Was it a natural talent, or did you take lessons?"
"Shut up," he said.
Mary looked around, startled.
"What?"
"Oh, Chancellor," he said. "I get so sick of gloom and doom from John Chancellor and Walter Cronkite and the rest of them."
"You shouldn't hate the messenger because of the message," she said,
and looked at John Chancellor with doubtful, troubled eyes. "I suppose so," he said, and thought, "You bastard, Freddy." Freddy told him not to hate the messenger for the message. They watched the news in silence for a while. A commercial for a cold medicine came on. Two men whose heads had been turned into blocks of snot. When one of them took the cold pill, the gray-green cube that had been encasing his head fell off in large lumps. "Your cold sounds better tonight," he said.
"It is. Bart, what's the realtor's name?"
"Monahan," he said automatically. "No, not the man that's selling you the plant, the one that's selling the house." "Olson," he said promptly, picking the name out of an internal litter bag. The news came on again. There was a report on David Ben-Gurion, who was about to join Harry Truman in that great secretariat in the sky.
"How does Jack like it out there?"
she asked presently. He was going to tell her Jack didn't like it at all, and heard himself saying, "Okay, I guess." John Chancellor closed out with a humorous item about flying saucers over Ohio. He went to bed at 10:30 and must have had the bad dream almost at once. When he woke up, the digital clock said 11:22 p.m. In the dream, he had been standing on a corner in Norton, the corner of Venner and Rice Street. He'd been standing right under the street sign. Down the street, in front of a candy store, a pink pimpmobile with caribou antlers mounted on the hood had just pulled up. Kids began to run toward it from stoops and porches. Across the street, a large black dog was chained to the railing of a leaning brick tenement. A little boy was approaching it confidently. He tried to cry out, "Don't pet that dog. Go get your candy." But the words wouldn't come out. As if in slow motion, the pimp in the white suit and planter's hat turned to look. All the children around the pimp were black, but the little boy approaching the dog was white. The dog struck, catapulting up from its haunches like a blunt arrow. The boy screamed and staggered backward, hands to his throat. When he turned around, the blood was streaming through his fingers. It was Charlie. That was when he had wakened. The dreams, the goddamn dreams. His son had been dead 3 years. November 28, 1973. It was snowing when he got up, but it had almost stopped by the time he got to the laundry. Tom Granger came running out of the plant in his shirt sleeves, his breath making short, stiff plumes in the cold air. He knew from the expression on Tom's face that it was going to be a crummy day. "We've got trouble, Bart." "Bad?" "Bad enough. Johnny Walker had an accident on his way back from Holiday Inn with his first load. Guy in a Pontiac skidded through a red light on Diekman and hit him dead center. Kapow!" He paused and looked aimlessly back toward the loading doors. There was no one there. "The cop said Johnny was in a bad way." "Holy Christ." "I got out there 15 or 20 minutes after it happened. You know the intersection?" Yeah, it's a bitch." Tom shook his head. "If it wasn't so fucking awful, you'd have to laugh. It looks like somebody threw a bomb at a washerwoman. There's Holiday Inn sheets and towels everywhere. Some people were stealing them, the fucking ghouls. Can you believe what people will do? And the truck? Right, there's nothing left from the driver's side door up. Just junk. Johnny got thrown." "Is he at Central?" "No, St. Mary's. Johnny's a Catholic, didn't you know that? You want to drive over with me?" "I better not. Ron's hollering for pressure on the boiler." He shrugged, embarrassed. "You know Ron, the show must go on." "All right." He got back into his car and drove out toward St. Mary's Hospital. Jesus Christ, of all the people for it to happen to. Johnny Walker was the only person left at the laundry beside himself who had been working at the Blue Ribbon in 1953. Johnny, in fact, went back to 1946. The thought lodged in his throat like an omen. He knew from reading the papers that the 784 extension was going to make the dangerous Diekman intersection pretty much obsolete. His name wasn't Johnny at all, not really. He was Corey Everett Walker. He had seen it on enough time cards to know that. But he had been known as Johnny even 20 years ago. His wife had died in 1956 on a vacation trip in Vermont. Since then, he had lived with his brother, who drove a sanitation truck for the city. There were dozens of workers at the Blue Ribbon who called Ron Stoneballs behind his back. But Johnny had been the only one to use it to his face and get away with it. He thought, if Johnny dies, I'm the oldest employee the laundry has got. Held over for a 20th record-breaking year. Isn't that a sketch, Fred? Fred didn't think so. Johnny's brother was sitting in the waiting room of the emergency wing. A tall man with Johnny's features and high complexion, dressed in olive work clothes and a black cloth jacket. He was twirling an olive-colored cap between his knees and looking at the floor. He glanced up at the sound of footsteps. "You from the laundry?" he asked. "Yes, you're..." He didn't expect the name to come to him, but it did. "Arnie, right?" "Yeah, Arnie Walker." He shook his head slowly. "I don't know, Mr. Dawes." "I don't know, Mr. Dawes. I seen him in one of those examining rooms. He looked pretty banged up. He ain't a kid anymore." "He looked bad." "I'm very sorry," he said. "That's a bad corner. It wasn't the other guy's fault. He just skidded in the snow. I don't blame the guy. They say he broke his nose, but that was all. It's funny the way those things work out, you know what?" "Yes. I remember one time when I was driving a big rig for Hemingway. This was in the early 60s.
and I was on the Indiana toll road, and I saw... The outer door banged open, and a priest came in. He stamped snow from his boots and then hurried up the corridor, almost running. Arnie Walker saw him, and his eyes widened and took on the glazed look of shock. He made a whining, gasping noise in his throat and tried to stand up. He put an arm around Arnie's shoulders and restrained him.
Jesus!
Arnie cried.
He had his picks. Did you see it? He's going to give him the last rites. Maybe he's dead already. Johnny!
There were other people in the waiting room. A teenage kid with a broken arm. An elderly woman with an elastic bandage around one leg. A man with his thumb wrapped in a giant dressing. They looked up at Arnie and then down, self-consciously, at their magazines. Take it easy, he said meaninglessly.
Let me go, Arnie said. I got to go see.
Listen.
Let me go!
He let him go. Arnie Walker went around the corner and out of sight, the way the priest had gone. He sat in the plastic contour seat for a moment, wondering what to do. He looked at the floor, which was covered with black, slushy tracks. He looked at the nurse's station, where a woman was covering a switchboard. He looked out the window and saw that the snow had stopped. There was a sobbing scream from up the corridor where the examining rooms were. Everybody looked up, and the same half-sick expression was on every face. Another scream, followed by a harsh, braying cry of grief. Everyone looked back at their magazines. The kid with the broken arm swallowed audibly, producing a small click in the silence. He got up and went out quickly, not looking back. At the laundry, everyone on the floor came over, and Ron Stone didn't stop them. I don't know, he told them. I never found out if he was alive or dead. You'll hear, I just don't know. He fled upstairs, feeling weird and disconnected. Do you know how Johnny is, Mr. Dosh? Phyllis asked him. He noticed for the first time that Phyllis, jaunty blue-rinsed hair notwithstanding, was looking old. He's bad, he said. The priest came to give him the last rites. Oh, what a dirty shame, and so close to Christmas. Did someone go out to Diekman to pick up his load? She looked at him a little reproachfully. Tom sent out Harry Jones. He brought it in 5 minutes ago. Good, he said, but it wasn't good. It was bad. He thought of going down to the washroom and dumping enough hex light into the washers to disintegrate all of it. When the extract ended and Pollock opened the machines, there would be nothing but a pile of gray fluff. That would be good. Phyllis had said something and he hadn't heard. What? I'm sorry. I said that Mr. Ordner called. He wants you to call back right away. And a fellow named Harold Swinnerton. He said the cartridges had come in. Harold? And then he remembered Harvey's gun shop. Only Harvey, like Marley, was as dead as a doornail. Yes, right. He went into his office and closed the door. The sign on his desk still said, "Think, it may be a new experience." He took it off the desk and dropped it into the waste basket. Clunk. He sat behind his desk, took everything out of the in-basket and threw it into the waste-basket without looking at it. He paused and looked around the office. The walls were wood-paneled. On the left were two framed degrees, one from college, one from the Laundry Institute, where he had gone during the summers of 1969 and 1970. Behind the desk was a large blow-up of himself shaking hands with Ray Tarkington in the Blue Ribbon parking lot just after it had been hot-topped. He and Ray were smiling. The laundry stood in the background, three trucks backed into the loading bay. The smokestack still looked very white. He had been in this office since 1967, over 6 years, since before Woodstock, before Kent State, before the assassination of Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King, since before Nixon. Years of his life had been spent between these four walls. Millions of breaths, millions of heartbeats. He looked around, seeing if he felt anything. He felt faintly sad, that was all. He cleaned out his desk, throwing away personal papers and his personal account books. He wrote his resignation on the back of a printed wash formula and slipped it into a laundry pay envelope. He left the impersonal things, the paper clips, the scotch tape, the big book of checks, the pile of blank time cards held together with rubber bands. He got up,
took the 2 degrees off the wall and threw them into the wastebasket. The glass covering the Laundry Institute diploma shattered. The squares where the degrees had hung all these years were a little brighter than the rest of the wall, and that was all. The phone rang, and he picked it up, thinking it would be Ortner. But it was Ron Stone calling from downstairs. Bart? Yeah. Johnny passed away a half hour ago. I guess he never really had a chance. I'm very sorry. I want to shut it down the rest of the day, Ron. Ron sighed.
That's best, I guess. But won't you catch hell from the big bosses?
I don't work for the big bosses anymore. I just wrote my resignation. There. It was out. That made it real. A dead beat of silence on the other end. He could hear the washers and the steady thumping hiss of the ironer. The mangler, they called it, on account of what would happen to you if you ever got caught in it.
I must have heard you wrong, Ron said finally.
I thought you said... I said it, Ron. I'm through. It's been a pleasure working with you and Tom and even Vinny when he could keep his mouth shut. But it's over.
Hey, listen, Bart. Take it easy. I know this has got you upset.
It's not over, Johnny, he said, not knowing if it was true or not. Maybe he still would have made an effort to save himself, to save the life that had existed under a protective dome of routine for the last 20 years. But when the priest had walked quickly past them down the hall, almost running, to the place where Johnny lay dying or dead, and when Arnie Walker had made that funny whining noise high up in his throat, he had given up. Like driving a car in a skid, or fooling yourself that you were driving, and then just taking your hands off the wheel and putting them over your eyes. It's not over, Johnny, he repeated.
Well, listen. Listen.
Ron sounded very upset. Look, I'll talk to you later, Ron, he said, not knowing if he would or not. Go on, have them punch out.
Okay, but...
He hung up gently. He took the phone book out of the drawer and looked in the yellow pages under Guns. He dialed Harvey's gun shop.
Hello, Harvey's.
This is Barton Dawes, he said.
Oh, right. Those shells came in late yesterday afternoon. I told you I'd have them in plenty of time for Christmas. 200 rounds.
Good. Listen, I'm going to be awfully busy this afternoon. Are you open tonight?
Open nights until 9, right up to Christmas.
Okay, I'll try to get in around 8. If not, tomorrow afternoon for sure.
Good enough. Listen, did you find out if it was Boca Rio?
Boca Rio, where his cousin Nick Adams would soon be hunting. Boca Rio. Yeah, I think it was.
Jesus, I envy him. That was the best time I ever had in my life.
Shaky ceasefire holds, he said. A sudden image came to him of Johnny Walker's head mounted over Stephen Ordner's electric log fireplace with a small polished bronze plaque beneath saying, Homo Laundromat, November 28, 1973, bagged on the corner of Diekman.
What was that?
Harry Swinnerton asked, puzzled. I said I envy him, too, he said and closed his eyes. A wave of nausea raced through him. I'm cracking up, he thought. This is called cracking up.
Oh. Well, I'll see you then.
Sure. Thanks again, Mr. Swinnerton. He hung up, opened his eyes, and looked around his denuded office again. He flicked the button on the intercom. Phyllis?
Yes, Mr. Dawes?
Johnny died. We're going to shut it down.
I saw people leaving and thought he must have.
Phyllis sounded as if she might have been crying. See if you can get Mr. Ordner on the phone before you go, will you?
Surely.
He swiveled around in his chair and looked out the window. A road grader, bright orange, was lumbering by with chains on its oversized wheels, lashing at the road. This is their fault, Freddy. All their fault. I was doing okay until those guys down at City Hall decided to rip up my life. I was doing fine, right, Freddy? Freddy? Fred? The phone rang, and he picked it up. Dawes.
You've gone crazy, Steve Ordner said flatly. Right out of your mind.
What do you mean?
I mean that I personally called Mr. Monahan this morning at 9:30.
The McCann people signed the papers on the Waterford plant at 9 o'clock. Now, what the fuck happened, Barton?
I think we'd better discuss that in person.
So do I, and I think you ought to know that you're going to have to do some fast talking if you want to save your job.
Stop playing games with me, Steve.
What?
You've got no intention of keeping me on, not even as the sweeper. I've written my resignation already. It's sealed up, but I can quote it from memory. I quit. Signed, Barton George Dawes.
But why?
He sounded physically wounded, but he wasn't whining like Arnie Walker. He doubted if Steve Ordner had done any whining since his 11th birthday. Whining was the last resort of lesser men. 2 o'clock?
Yeah.
2 is fine. Goodbye, Steve.
Bart.
He hung up and looked blankly at the wall. After a while, Phyllis poked her head in, looking tired and nervous and bewildered beneath her smart, older person hairdo. Seeing her boss sitting quietly in his denuded office did nothing to improve her state of mind.
Mr. Dawes, should I go? I'd be glad to stay if...
No, go on, Phyllis. Go home. She seemed to be struggling to say something else, and he turned around and looked out the window, hoping to spare them both embarrassment. After a moment, the door snicked closed very softly. Downstairs, the boiler whined and died. Motors began to start up in the parking lot. He sat in his empty office, in the empty laundry, until it was time to go and see Ordner. He was saying goodbyes. Ordner's office was downtown, in one of the new high-rise office buildings that the energy crisis might soon make obsolete. 70 stories high, all glass, inefficient to heat in winter, a horror to cool in summer. Amerigo's offices were on the 54th floor. He parked his car in the basement parking lot, took the escalator up to lobby level, went through a revolving door, and found the right bank of elevators. He rode up with a black woman who had a large afro. She was wearing a jumper and was holding a steno notebook. "I like your afro," he said abruptly, for no reason. She looked at him coolly and said nothing, nothing at all. The reception room of Stephen Ordner's office was furnished with free-form chairs and a red-headed secretary who sat beneath a reproduction of Van Gogh's Sunflowers. There was an oyster-colored shag rug on the floor. Indirect lighting. Indirect Muzak, piping Montovani. The redhead smiled at him. She was wearing a black jumper, and her hair was bound with a hank of gold yarn.
"Mr. Dawes?"
"Yes." "Go right in, please." He opened the door and went right in. Ordner was writing something at his desk, which was topped with an impressive slab of lucite. Behind him, a huge window gave on a western view of the city. He looked up and put his pen down.
"Hello, Bart," he said quietly.
"Hello."
"Sit down."
"Is this going to take that long?"
Ordner looked at him fixedly. "I'd like to slap you," he said.
"Do you know that?
I'd like to slap you all the way around this office. Not hit you or beat you up, just slap you."
"I know that," he said, and did.
"I don't think you have any idea of what you threw away," Ordner said.
"I suppose the McCann people got to you. I hope they paid you a lot. Because I had you personally earmarked for an executive vice presidency in this corporation. That would have paid $35,000 a year to start. I hope they paid you more than that."
"They didn't pay me a cent."
"Is that the truth?"
"Yes."
"Then why, Bart? Why in the name of God?"
"Why should I tell you, Steve?"
He took the chair he was supposed to take, the supplicant's chair, on the other side of the big lucite-topped desk. For a moment, Ordner seemed to be at a loss. He shook his head the way a fighter will when he has been tagged, but not seriously.
"Because you're my employee. How's that for a start?"
"Not good enough."
"What does that mean?"
"Steve, I was Ray Tarkington's employee. He was a real person. You might not have cared for him, but you had to admit he was real. Sometimes when you were talking to him, he broke wind or burped or picked dead skin out of his ear. He had real problems. Sometimes I was one of them."
Once when I made a bad decision about billing a motel out in Crager Plaza, he threw me against a door. You're not like him. The blue ribbon is Tinker Toys to you, Steve. You don't care about me. You care about your own upward mobility. So don't give me that employee shit. Don't pretend you stuck your cock in my mouth and I bit it. If Ordner's face was a facade, there was no crack in it. His features continued to register modulated distress no more.
Do you really believe that? Ordner asked.
Yes. You only give a damn about the blue ribbon as it affects your status in the corporation, so let's cut the shit. Here. He slid his resignation across the lucite top of the desk. Ordner gave his head another little shake.
And what about the people you've hurt, Bart? The little people. Everything else aside, you were in a position of importance.
He seemed to taste the phrase.
What about the people at the laundry who are going to lose their jobs because there's no new plant to switch to?
He laughed harshly and said, "You cheap son of a bitch. You're too fucking high to see down, aren't you?" Ordner colored. He said carefully,
"You better explain that, Bart."
Every single wage earner at the laundry, from Tom Granger on down to Pollock in the washroom, has unemployment insurance. It's theirs. They pay for it. If you're having trouble with that concept, think of it as a business deduction, like a four-drink lunch at Benjamin's.
Stung, Ordner said, "That's welfare money, and you know it." He reiterated, "You cheap son of a bitch." End of side 12. Change side selector switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.